Can I introduce you to Craig Ray?
Who, if you've read these posters, which obviously you have done, otherwise you wouldn't be here, you'll know all about him. He's the, hopefully you've read his books as well. And if you haven't, I'd literally left my own copy. So, Andrew, could you speak? It's a killer's blind, otherwise I'm going to lose my sight about halfway through this discussion. So, that's cool. So Craig just made a mercilessly Tam O'Shanter-like dash all the way from Oxford. And about 4:13, and he's straight to this. So, the first question.
I just finished giving a seminar, actually, in Oxford. Yeah,
I've just also heard the news that Craig once came to this department.
Yeah.
To get a job, and he didn't get it.
I applied to be the creative writing fellow. Can't remember who did get it now. Ken Smith was there too. He didn't get it either.
Yeah.
I absolutely don't remember who it was who carried off this incredible bauble.
The bauble that pays you £7,500 for a full year's work. That particular.
Yeah, that's the
large.
Well, yeah. I could have done with £7,500 then.
So now you know how much I'm paid.
But we're not every penny.
Craig, I have some questions worked out for you. I'm sure you stay in Sheffield. And the first question is the one I ask everybody who comes here, whether Jane Rogers, Peter Porter, or Martin Amis, which is, can you tell us first how you approach writing as something you can do in a lifetime, or how writing approached you, and how your reading was part of that process? Could you talk us through that for about 15 minutes?
Yeah,
gosh.
Reading. I came from a house where there weren't any books. Still aren't any books, actually, apart from my old Anglo-Saxon primer. My Beowulf and a few other things that I haven't somehow kept up with over the years. I went away to a boarding school where I did sort of read a bit. And I remember a sort of terrible shaming moment at the end of my first year at school when I was 12. And they were having a sort of purge on library books that had been out of the library forever. And it turned out I'd had Swallows and Amazons out for a whole year. My English master, he was a nice guy called Arnold Snodgrass, who was a friend of Auden's, but I think when they were at Oxford together, it's rather keen. And he said, so how can you have this book out for so long? What happens in it? And I'd only got up to page 28. So I really didn't start reading properly until I was about 14. And then when I got into I didn't read that much then. And when I got into the sixth form, there was a sort of group of, I suppose we thought we were rather cool, bunch of people who hung out in the library where we took out various things. And it was sort of smart to read things that nobody else read. So I got Eliot's Four Quartets out and read them. Didn't understand a word. And thought, actually, this is what modern poetry is. It's this stuff you write that no one can understand. I think I could write some of that. So I set about writing some of that, this stuff that no one could understand. And after a bit, I gave some to this English master. He was quite ferocious. And we had a sort of fiction that it was written by a friend of mine. And I showed the... Sorry?
That was Chris Reed.
No. I didn't meet Chris until much later.
No, that was a joke.
Oh, sorry. we go back a long way ago. Not quite that far back.
How did the teacher respond to it?
He hated it. He said, tell your friend these poems are like pimply Dylan Thomas. And what you should do is stop using the word I. And you should learn about scansion, meter, rhyme, all that kind of thing. So I said, yes, I'll tell my friend. And went off. And actually, if you look at my first book, The Only Memory, there's hardly an I in it. And I carried this rule around with me for ages. And I, to tell you the truth, I don't really have a sense of what those poems were really like, because I forgot them. But I did send some to Philip Toynbee, who was then the, There used to be this sort of star reviewing spot in the Sunday paper. Cyril Connolly was the Sunday Times star reviewer, and Philip Toynbee was the star reviewer for the Observer. And I sent these poems to him, and as I remembered, he wrote back a very kind letter. And I completely forgot about it. And then about 10 years ago, he died. And Blake Morrison was then the literary editor of the Observer, and rang me up and said that Philip Toynbee's widow had been along, and they'd been going through his file. And there was this letter with poems from somebody called Craig A. Rain, age 16. What should he do with them? And I said, burn them. He said, no, you couldn't do that. I'll send you a photocopy. So the photocopy duly arrived. And it's difficult to explain how embarrassed I was. It was mainly the letter was colossally arrogant. It began by saying, "Dear Philip Toynbee, I read your column every week, and occasionally I agree with you. I wonder if you'd be so kind as to look at these poems I'm sending you. Though it doesn't matter whether you like them or not, because I'm going to go ahead and be a great poet anyway." And after, I just couldn't turn the page. I couldn't even look at them. So I passed them to my wife, who read them with gales of laughter. And I said to her, "What are they like?" She said, "They're incredibly religious, and they have lots of exclamation marks." And that's all I know about them. So obviously, the four quartets thing had bitten at once deeply and shallowly. So that's what they were like. I mean, I don't know where the writing ambition comes from. Basically a desire to be different at school. I mean, no one else was writing poetry, so I wrote poetry.
How did you go on from there to the...
Well, then I started to read properly. And by the time I was 16, I really was reading a lot. And it was as though I was some sort of desiccant in the library. You know, I'd go in there and all the kind of moisture and goodness from all the books would kind of, you know, I'd absorb it instantly. And I did read a lot. One of the people I read was Hemingway. So that for a time, well, certainly my first year at Oxford, I had a kind of file of dumb poems that no one would publish, quite rightly. But I was mainly writing short stories. And I had this idea that I couldn't really be a proper writer until I'd seen a bullfight. It seemed to be sort of necessary for this. Now, I don't know that as an undergraduate, yeah, I wrote short stories. They were terrible too. Also very embarrassing. And then as a graduate student, I met a girl who said to me, "What do you do?" And I said, "I'm a graduate student." And she said, "Yeah, well, everyone's a graduate student. What do you do?" And I said, "Well, you know, I write poetry." And she said, "That's fantastic. Can I see some?" So I went whizzing back to my flat and started to write. I'm afraid it's absolutely true. And then didn't stop. And I mean, I suppose is that most people can write. Everybody can write a bit, and I should suppose most people in this room have written a poem. It's very odd to meet somebody who's never written a single poem in their lives, but most people don't go on, they don't persist. And I think, you know, they don't persist because, I don't know, they get jobs, there's lots of stuff to do, they have responsibilities, you know, there's no money in poetry. So that's that. It just atrophies, you know. So the people who could have written quite well don't go on writing.
Where does your persistence come from, though? Because you have lots of jobs, you have lots of responsibilities, you have a family.
Well,
how did you manage to negotiate the endurance test?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. You have somewhere inside you this notion that, well, actually, Charlie Citrine in Humpel's Gift has this wonderful phrase, which is used ironically, and I'm using it ironically as well, where he says, you know, "I felt I had special information in a kind of sealed envelope, and what you had to do is find out what the envelope was and open it." And I suppose it's that sense. And also, you think what you're writing is very good when it's crap. So that one was writing this stuff that I now think was no good. I mean, I didn't really start writing at all well, I think, until I was 24, 25. And I think before that it was all derivative, and it was all like the people I admired. And it seemed enough then to be writing a poem that was recognisably like Robert Lowell, for instance. And you'd think, Lowell did that, I'm doing this. And it, somehow the idea of having, you know, your own voice wasn't something I was aware of. And when it happened, it wasn't entirely joyous. I mean, what happened was that you'd give poems to your friends who would look at them and laugh and say, this sounds like you, i.e. it wasn't authentic. And it took some time to kind of persuade them that, you know, what sounded like me was also valid in some kind of wider way.
How did you recognise that poem when you hit your own style?
Because it just does sound like you. You know, the cadences sound like the way you talk. But I've always been intensely metaphorical. And somehow when that started to kind of show, and that's what people recognised, it was like listening to me when I was kind of flying in conversation. And yeah, they recognised that. So I suppose that, yeah, I mean, and then you realise that, you know, this is sort of what you're doing, and I guess what you do is you maximise it. I mean, Paul Valéry says in Analects somewhere that in order to be a writer, you have to be able to imitate yourself, which is, I suppose, the opposite of what Hopkins is saying when he talks about Parnassian in that famous letter to A.W. Bailey when he's an undergraduate in 1853-54 at Balliol, where he says, you know, I've just read Enoch Arden's kind of terrible. You know, what Tennyson is doing is writing Parnassian. By Parnassian, I mean, it's like Tennyson, but it's not absolutely inspired Tennyson at the top of his bend. And I think that's, as a critical precept, has entered in lit in a way that I think is slightly incorrect. You know, you do have to be able to imitate yourself. So, you know, you see what you do and you do it slightly more, you slightly exaggerate it, and gradually it emerges as this is the thing that you do. But I think all writers have this. I mean, I used to edit a magazine called Quarto, which was a literary monthly, and we did it from a sort of basement in London. God, it was so cold in the winter, I can't tell you. And I rang Angela Carter and said I was looking for short stories, and she was then teaching at the UEA creative writing course, and she said that she had this rather clever Japanese called Ishiguro, and would I like to see some of his stuff. So she sent me this story, which I read, and it was an absolute perfect replica of an Ian McEwan story. It was about a boy who slept with his sister and murdered the rest of his family. So it had all that kind of slightly sicko spin to it, which is obviously what he read. So I sent it back saying, this is a terrific Ian McEwan story, but it's not what I want. If I want that, I'm going to go to Ian McEwan. And about, I guess, a year later, it must have been at the end of Isha's course, he sent me another story, which was about eating that fish which, you know, is likely to be poisonous, called fugu. Say it was a Japanese context, and it was completely different. So I rang him up and said, yeah, I'll take the story. And then he came to see me in London, and we went to a pub called the Queen's Head and Artichoke, which is on Albany Street, and had a drink together. And I said, so what happened? And he said, well, I had a long talk with Clive Sinclair, who's a Jewish novelist, I'm going to email his work. And Clive was also teaching at UEA. And Clive used to work in advertising. And apparently he said to Ish, you have to decide what your USP is. And by USP he meant unique selling point. It's a kind of marketing term. And then he said to him, your unique selling point is that you're Japanese. And Ish said, but I was brought up in wherever you were brought up, Ilford, I think. Or Woking. And Sinclair said, no, but that's what you should do. You should concentrate on that. And that's how Ishiguro evolved this style, which is English, but curiously Japanese in flavour. And if you look at the Remains of the Day, I mean, as a novel, yeah, it suddenly becomes English, you know, set in England, Lord Darlington, all that stuff. But the main character is a very reticent butler, who's, I think, just sort of inches away from being Japanese, in his formality, in his delivery and so on. So, yes, what he did was he decided, you know, that he would go for this. I think the other thing, which is often underrated, but is absolutely essential, is I think that most stylistic decisions come from subject matter. I think subject matter is fantastically important. And it's really that that makes you write. You think, I mean, okay, that's the special information. You think, I know all of this. You know, I know this and nobody else knows this. This is what I have to say. And that subject matter, if there's enough pressure from the subject matter, that's what kind of changes your style, makes you make decisions, because you're actually serving the subject matter. And that pushes you in all kinds of directions.
Can I ask you about the decisions that you took outside of the writing? You could be described as, I could be described as another folk and contemporary sphere, which is quite an active person. You worked as an editor for Quarto, for instance. You were appointed as the editor for Poetry and Fable for 10 years. You do sundry activities outside of poetry, teaching, writing, criticism. What's the balance? How do you balance the two? I mean, why edit a magazine at particular stages of one's life? Are you trying to... Is a part of you that wants to create discrimination within a reader or a readership?
Well, there are always two reasons, David. I mean, you know, I got that job as an editor of Porsche completely by accident. I mean, before that, I was an academic. I was a lecturer at Oxford. And my lecturing job ran out. I was looking for another job. I applied for a job at UC, where Jeremy already was, and I didn't get the job. And I needed to earn some money. And then, I met somebody who said, listen, do you want to be editor of this magazine? Because the present editor has just had an offer from Time Life Books to write a book about the Dinka people. And then without an editor, would you do it? So I said, yeah. And that's how it happened. I mean, really, completely accidentally. Once you're doing it, yeah, of course you want to change things. I mean, you want to have a kind of interesting, controversial, feisty magazine that people want to read, slightly frightened to read, love reading, all that kind of stuff. And I suppose I was interested in having long, serious pieces about poetry. I mean, I can remember that I commissioned a very long piece by Blake Morrison on Elizabeth Bishop, who, when she died, there was absolutely nothing in the papers over here then. This is in 79, 80. And, you know, I think we ran that piece in... I think she died at the end of that sort of September 79, and we ran a huge piece on her. And that, you know, if May the following year, something like that. So that, yeah, you felt that you were doing something. I mean, I had a real crusade about her. I mean, I wanted her to be read. I mean, now it's not a problem. I mean, James Fenton was lecturing about her yesterday at Oxford. So, you know, yes, one wanted to kind of change a few things like that. But basically, doing all these different things and how you balance them, I mean, you do them because you have to earn a living. I mean, there's a bit of you that always thinks it must be wonderful just to write. But you have to earn a living, so all these other things. And you balance them by doing whichever one of them is going to inflict the greatest pain on you if you don't do it. So that actually it's true that when I edited the magazine, I didn't write any poetry for a year. I was the film critic, I was the gossip columnist, I did all the interviews and I did all the editing. So I didn't have time to write anything. And it was actually very successful, I mean, for those little magazines. And I gave it up after a year because I thought, I'll never write again. It's terrific fun editing a magazine. There's nothing like it. I mean, it's bliss. And it's kind of instant too, you know. The book arrives, you think who's going to review it, you ring them up, you know. A fortnight later, you've got the piece. A month, 2 weeks after that, you've printed it, and they haven't been paid. in our case, so there's quite a lot of that. But that was tremendous fun. And what I feel now is that, I mean, when Martin Amis got whatever it was, half a million quid for the information, my reaction was, you know, A, good for him, and also, thank goodness, because now he can have a kind of good rest. You know, he doesn't have to write another book in order to earn a living. And I would hate now, myself, to have to write in order to earn a living. I haven't written any poetry for 2 years, not a single poem, and it doesn't bother me. I'm not blocked. I just don't have anything to write. You know, I've written a libretto for an opera. I've just written a play, actually, in prose. But it would be sort of terrible to have to earn my living doing this when, because it seems to me that what you do is you end up repeating yourself. You know, and it gets ever more dilute until eventually you're publishing these homeopathic books that have a kind of the tiniest bit of you in them, and they're kind of hugely diluted. And I don't want to have to do that. So that for me, teaching is anyway, it's great fun, and I like doing it. You know, teaching Rosencrantz and Guildenstern this morning. You know, it's not a bad way to earn a living. Except you get tired and you forget what you're going to say next.
Can I ask you a final question for me before I say
yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed when I first read you, which was about 20 years old, say, was that each of your books is tightly organised as a book, like, say, Peter Redding's books are. They're not often written as books, but there's an impulse behind them, say, in Rich. And A Martian Sense of Postcard Home, where you get a sense of the thing being almost like a project, where you've organised, you've written the material beforehand, actually published it in magazines and journals. So when you actually sat down to send it to AU people to favour, you then crafted the whole thing as an entire text. Can you just talk briefly about that? Because it's not something that a lot of poets do with their collections. It's something that I admire a lot. Take a stand over the entire text rather than just having a ragbag of the script poems.
Well, the first book, The Onion Memory, is a ragbag, really. I mean, it's just a kind of accumulation. But I realise it's rather long for a first book, but it took me ages to get anything published. I'd say it was about kind of 10 years' work. And about half of the poems in it were never published in magazines anyway. But they sort of, they grew and grew. And actually, in a way, it was very good for me having them turned down, because it meant that I went on tinkering with them and actually improving them. I don't think there's anything that anyone's written that can't actually be improved. It's just that, you know, you kind of give up after a bit. And you think, it'll have to do. And then it's published, so you just leave it. But I thought, Christ, 98 pages, you know, it's a big first book. You know, and I wanted to kind of try and angle the reviews so they would have kind of handles. So I divided it into sections and gave them what I thought were kind of helpful hints to give this book a good review. But they cracked on it anyway. And it completely ignored all of that. And I think actually Martian Sense of Postcard Home, yeah, I was, you know, it was written in a very short space of time when it appeared the next year, because there was a hole in the AUP poetry list, so instead of having to wait for 3 years or something, I got in and I had this kind of tiny amount of poems. And I think the unity simply comes from them being written at more or less the same time. With Rich, no, I mean, I did organise it. And I had sort of... I had ideas. I mean, one of the things I wanted to do in the first half was to write a whole series of love poems that would sort of divide it up. I mean, instead of love being love, kind of monolithic, I would kind of take a hammer to it and see what was left. So there were poems about jealousy and sex and parental love and all this kind of thing. So that was a project. And also I was interested in I wanted to invent different languages. So there were a whole series of, you know, invented languages, and that was one project. And then they divided up in Richmond Point, that's fine. And I was actually then working at Faber's, and I said to my boss, could I have, I think, a month off work? And he said, what for? And I said, well, what I want to do is just sit down with his manuscript and see if it's okay. And he said, but don't you know that it's okay? And I said, well, A, I want to kind of see, you know, if the shape is right. I also want to say, taste all the words, you know, put them in my mouth and actually give myself time. And he said, what kind of thing? And there's one of my poems which ends, to an audience of two. And I was wondering whether you could have two twos so close to each other, even though differently spelled. So I explained to him this would take a kind of morning. just sort of... basically kind of, you know, sucking it and see. And he said, well, okay, it seemed to him pretty rum. And then he said, supposing you've done this before the month is up, will you come back to work early? And I said, yeah. And in fact, I think it took me about 3 weeks. And I thought, shit, I'm going to have to go back to work on Monday. And I remembered that I'd met a guy called Ben Sonnenberg, who edited a magazine called Grand Street in New York. And I'd been telling him about my background. And he was just very interested in it and said, would you write me a piece sometime about that? That would be interesting. And I'd done this sort of OU, Open University lecture about kind of, you know, my back. I can't remember how that came, but it was about 2 years before that. And I thought, well, why don't I just rework that piece and expand it, maybe? And then I'll send it to him. He'll pay me, I don't know, $200 or something. And so I started, and then he kind of completely burgeoned on my head. I got tremendously excited, couldn't stop writing. Kept coming downstairs and handing pages to my wife, who'd say, this is terrific, more of this, you know, get back upstairs. So I think that the prose in the middle of Rich, I wrote over about sort of 3 or 4 days as a kind of separate thing. And then I thought, oh Christ, of course, no, this fits. You know, absolutely is part of the book. It really does fit here. And I thought, but the problem is, it's mainly about my father and my mother, and they're still alive. And my problem was whether I could publish it or not. So I sent it off to them, saying, I would like to use this in my next book. But if you don't want me to, I won't. I didn't hear anything for about 3 days, and I thought, Christ, you know, I've really, you know, stepped out of line here. So I finally rang my mother. He says, no, you got it back. I sent it back to you. Corrections, you know, lots of things you've remembered slightly inaccurately. No, you think it's fine. And I said, well, what does Dad think? Because he's much more kind of, he's more the central figure. And she said, he thinks it should be funnier. Which is his kind of instinct for everything. And I said, but Mark, it could only be funny at his expense. And she said, yeah, I know, it's funny, isn't it? then I published it. And there was a sort of difficulty, as there often is with writing, because I thought, this is all right to have it in a book of poems. But when Fagus sent out proof copies, then the Observer offered me a review front. They wanted to do it on... When they used to have this thing called the review front, which was the arts pages, which had a kind of full page on the front. And if you got that, you got actually quite a lot of money. But anyway, I turned it down because I thought, you know, my father would just die in this furnace of publicity. So I said no. And then I found out later, after I'd said no, and very virtuously, how much money I would have got. Good job they didn't tell me. Because I think I would have... would have swayed a little.
Your dad could have invoiced you.
Yeah, he would have invoiced me.
In fact, there isn't a class of five. I've kicked them out, so they're not going to be strolling at the door. Does anybody have any questions? I know that Andrew has.
I'd like to ask you how helpful you find other people's criticism of your poems. I remember Tom Paulin once saying it was only the really shitty reviews that were useful to you. Do you agree with that?
I haven't read anything written about me since 1990.
Why not?
It's not because I don't mind. I mind intensely. That's why I don't read it. It's praise or blame. I mean, praise is just as horrible, kind of, you know, blows you off track, and, you know, you find yourself repeating whole sentences to yourself, and giving yourself a rosy glow again and again. And then the ones that kind of saw a leg off, and you think, my God. So I just decided I didn't want to read it. I wanted to get on with what I was doing. I don't think, honestly, to be absolutely, even when I read them, when I worked as a publisher, you see, I had to read everything. just as I had, it was part of my job to accept all kind of publicity assignments, you know. Pebble Mill at one, you had to do it, it was part of the job. And it was sort of wonderful becoming an academic again, because I didn't have to do any of that. And I thought, no, I don't have to read reviews either, or profiles, or any of that stuff, so I don't. But even before that, I don't think I ever learned anything that I didn't know already, honestly. Criticism is usually about the book behind. You know, when they're reviewing Rich, actually what they're doing is reviewing A Martian Sense of Postcard Home. When they're reviewing A Martian Sense of Postcard Home, they're reviewing The Onion Memory. And when they were reviewing The Onion Memory, they weren't reviewing anything, it seemed to me. I didn't learn anything. I mean, one's very close to it, and you put a lot in. Anyone who's been reviewed knows how disappointing even good reviews are, because there's no space. You know, they never get to grips with it. You know, it's this, and yet another kind of excellent volume from da-da, and you think, is that it? I think the world's greatest disappointment must be appearing in a Faber introduction. Because you get tremendously excited. I mean, that's where I first appeared. I just thought, you know, this is amazing. I do not believe this. At last, you know, my name in print, all that stuff. And then the book comes out, and at the end of a long mass review, like a mass grave, there's a bit that says, Faber's continued their interesting policy of publishing young, unpublished books. Full stop. And that's it. And in a way, it improves after that, but it doesn't improve significantly. I remember a really quite good review. By a man called John Osborne in a magazine from Hull, and another one in a magazine called Straight Lines. And these appeared, you know, nearly a year after the book had come out. But they were actually serious attempts to get to grips with the things, you know, they sort of three pages or something. Actually looking at the poems. Not uncritically, but yeah, and they were interesting. But mostly, no. And when you read a piece in the newspapers, do you take it seriously? I suppose it depends.
That's rather a hard question for Andrew, because he writes for the Telegraph.
Writes for the Telegraph, yeah.
Do we take it seriously when you read your own work in the Telegraph, Andrew?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah, well,
you publish a book of your own journalism as well,
yeah,
so
I
would
know.
You make an exception for that?
Well, I don't think there's a piece there that's much under 1,000 words. And obviously I've done kind of shorter pieces now, but actually I do think that they're, you know, less interesting, less important. And one of the things I used to love about writing the London Review of Books is they never gave you a length. They just gave you the book and said, okay, could we have your piece, you know, more or less when it was ready? So you would take time off and do a lot of work. And it was worth it. I mean, I also did short reviews for the Oxford Mail. I didn't reprint any of them. you'd be reviewing 42 books in 600 words. It was crazy. And I think a lot of the stuff is like that. I mean, I don't know what you can say usefully about somebody who's in any way serious in one of those little paragraphs. You know, you can hardly quote anything. And it has to be that way. There's no way around it. You can't say to the Sunday Times, you know, you should address poetry more, because if they did, they'd be out of business, and the editor would be breathing down the literary editor's neck, saying, you know, come on, you know, we want John Le Carré or Ruth Rendell. That's what we want. We want Keegan on, you know, and the latest biography of Yeats, you know, Roy Foster or something. Yeah, they want names, and so it's not ideal. Actually, I mean, I think the Sunday Times has much improved of late, and they do have longer pieces.
So you think that the place for this activity to continue and be refreshed is magazines like Bent Noir and other small presses? or near things like Thumbscrew? I mean, is that where we should be looking? Is that where people should look?
Well, I think it's more likely to be serious, though. I mean, it's more likely to be, you know, engaged. Yeah, I would have thought so.
How many of those do you read? Do you still subscribe to those magazines?
Well, I see Thumbscrew, but I don't read it about me. Probably just as well. And I read some pieces, you know, I mean, the interview with Muldoon or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't any longer feel a sort of absolute need to keep up either. You know, I mean, I've got a job to do, and that's, you know, what I do first. And on top of that, I mean, I just don't feel, you know, abreast of things in the way you have to be when you're a publisher of contemporary poetry. Poetry Review I look at occasionally. But yes, I mean, I think it is more serious than newspaper journalism. It has to be. I mean, sorry, I don't mean that. You're not serious. I mean, I always, listen, when I wrote for papers, I always took myself, you know, you did it as well as you could, but there are absolute limitations on it. And I think what I wrote for the Oxford Mail is absolutely worthless, really. Yeah, bound to be 60 books.
60 books in...
Well, it wasn't 60. I mean, you would get 60 and you'd have to do sort of 15 of them. And I was paid sort of, you know, 15 quid. I mean, so the whole thing was, you know, basically listing, you know. You'd say, this is a new book by Larkin, you know, terribly interesting. On to the next one, you know.
What's the way out of this thing? I mean, we're told time and time again, some of us have played a role in this, that contemporary poetry is on a boom. New Generation Poets, for example. The expansion of the Poetry Society, poetry cafes. And yet, still, there is no serious coverage or serious criticism of contemporary poetry in the national media. It still exists in smaller magazines.
But, I mean, does that... I mean, as long as it exists somewhere, it seems to me that's fine.
I suppose what I see is a...
I mean, isn't the history of modernism a history of that, too?
A break between the promotion of poetry, where there's an awful lot of sort of fluff, if you like, of hype, and the serious criticism. There actually seems to be a fracture now that exists, and very little connection between the two.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm not actually against the fluff and the hype either. I mean, if people accidentally get books into their hands for whatever reasons of marketing, promotion, whatever. I mean, I think competitions, poetry competitions, are intrinsically absurd. How do you choose between one terrific poem and another terrific poem? It doesn't mean anything. But actually, in terms of promotion, publicity, yeah, very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, lots of people get to get free clothes or something by, you know, dressing up for Vogue, why not? It's really what I think. I mean, you know, if they want to do it, they want to do it. I mean,
Craig is referring to an episode where I think 8 contemporary poets, some of whom were usually dressed rather like me, had to dress up in black tank tops and ski trousers, didn't they? Stand on top of
this is something completely different. Now, I remember being asked by, I think, Vogue to, you know, I don't know, wear a Paul Smith suit. I mean, you could sort of choose and Calvin Klein underpants and all kinds of stuff. And they kind of rang up and said, you know, would you do this? There'd be a kind of big photo, maybe a big spread in Vogue. And I said, no, I'm too ugly. There are lots of good-looking younger men who'd want to do this. And they duly did. And actually, they survived it, seemed to me, rather well. There was a certain amount of kind of flack and piss-taking, but actually, no, they survived it, and fine, you know, why not? And I hope they got some decent clothes out of it.
Has anybody else got some questions? David.
In this book, in some of the poems, you're looking at life from a stranger's perspective. Sometimes, do you think that using that technique of estrangement sometimes can sort of make an ansali of an experience? Can it sort of oversimplify it to be estranged from it almost. Is that a, you know, I'm not saying it's not a danger, but.
Well, I mean, in theory, yes. I mean, yeah, it's possible. I didn't actually think of it that way. It seems to me that what one does is one looks very carefully. I mean, that seems to me that, you know, what writing is about. It's about looking at things carefully. And I remember years ago, somebody at the reading said to me, yeah, everybody goes on about how kind of precise your images are, but, you know, they're not. And I said, you know, fine. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. He said, for instance, there's this poem where you compare one of your daughter's teeth to a segment of sweet corn, and teeth are white and sweet corn is yellow. They're completely different. And I said, well, that's very interesting, because you haven't looked at a tooth, nor have you looked at sweet corn. Yeah, sweet corn isn't yellow, just look at it. And teeth, damn well, aren't white. You know, dentists spend a whole lot of time, you know, getting a match for your teeth. You're all too young to have crowns. But when you do, you know, the dentist shows you the crown. It's fantastically clever. I mean, it's done wonderfully well, but what it isn't is white. You know, it's the match for the rest of your teeth. And if you, you can test this. When you see a clown at the circus whose face is whited up and he smiles, the teeth are yellow. They're much closer to sweet corn. If you look at sweet corn, yellow, yes, but, you know, a whole variety of shades there. It's very interesting. So I would say that, you know, it's to do with looking carefully. And I don't, therefore, think that it does, you know, as it were, reduce reality. It seems to me it serves it. I mean, my artistic credo is Conrad's, as expressed in the preface to the Ring of Narcissus, you know, when he says, it's my business to do with words, it's to make you feel, to make you hear, to make you see. To make you see above all, nothing much and it is everything. And I think by see he means kind of comprehend as well. But simply handing across the reality, if you like, slightly more focused, is what I would say I was doing or trying to do. And I suppose that also goes for emotions too. I mean, I think, people often want poetry to underwrite the consensus and limit it to a series of, you know, rather crude emotions, like, for instance, you know, people die and you experience grief. But, you know, you only have to read In Memoriam to know that grief isn't a kind of single thing. It's an extended state, and it varies. It's a whole spectrum of things, and you have to be true to that. So what you're constantly doing in poetry, it seems to me, is resisting what, as it were, the poetry of the past is forcing you to do, or what any given consensus is. I mean, literary theory is constantly telling you that the writer is, in fact, not in charge. What's in charge is the kind of the reigning ideologies, which are, you know, all kind of writing themselves through the writer. But it seems to me the writer's business is to know either intuitively or consciously what those ideologies are and resist them.
So, one more question.
Oh, it's more of a comment. Is that all right? I've just started reading something. Really, just barely started reading Peter Ackroyd's biography of Blake. Which came out just this year, and I know I'm going to like it. I think I'm going to like it because it does what you've just been saying in answer to his question, is that he stands back, and to be detached or to be looking at what all the influences are and the ideologies and detaching yourself from them and then trying to look very closely at something isn't necessarily sometimes that if you want to call that estrangement, it can be a good thing because it makes takes you away from this incredible subjectiveness of looking at something just through an ideology. The example I would give is that Blake, a lot of people have said that a lot of sort of people in the psychoanalytic ideology have said that Blake is, well, most of his work is just rebellion against his own father and that sort of thing. And Peter Ackroyd says, well, no, you know, these things still mean something to us, these works. You don't have to have this tacked on Freudian theory to have, for many people to get something very clear from Blake's view. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, no, I mean, the artwork is made, isn't it? And so that... It's not that the artwork is a kind of veil which you have to kind of pull aside to see what is really being said here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's actually saying something, it's made, it has its own satisfactions, it has its own form. Yeah,
yeah, that's what Peter Robert says. It's very, I found that helpful because quite often, we're talking about criticism and we tend to kind of try to hijack something and say it's on a different rail than it's perhaps on, you know, to fit it into some current ideology.
I'm going to hijack this now.
Sorry.
What you've done is you've taken maybe 20 people who will now spend the next 2 hours walking around the university campus with their mouths firmly shut, just in case they smile and people point at them and say, sweet corn. So Craig will be reading tonight at 7:15, the conference room in the Arts Centre, and then whizzing back down to Oxford. I'd like to thank you extremely much for coming along for this pre-reading discussion and for allowing it to be recorded and talking at length and answering those questions extremely carefully. Thank you very much for coming. Very great.
The ugly officer, as brutally as he had snatched her daughter, or with more brutality if more in man could be, seized her son so beautiful and tore him from her arms. She, patient as before, gave him no sign of suffering in her loss, but kissed her son and signed him with the cross. But yet she begged the fellow, if he might, to close a little body in a grave, his tender limbs so delicate to sight. She sought in her extremity to save from bird and beast, but not a sign he gave, and snatched the child with careless cruelty and bore it to Bologna, tenderly. The Marquis wondered ever more and more at so much patience in her misery. Had he not known for certain, long before, how perfectly she loved her children, he would have supposed some cunning devilry of malice, some heart's cruelty, or base indifference beneath their constant face. But well the Marquis knew it was no mask, for she had ever loved her children best, next to himself. And I would like to ask of women, had he made sufficient test? Could stubborn husband fancy or suggest more that would prove a steadfast wifeliness to one continuing stubborn to excess? But there are folk in such a state of mind that, if they finally resolve to take some certain course to which they feel inclined, cannot hold back. This is Chaucer's justification here. But there are folk in such a state of mind that, if they finally resolve to take some certain course to which they feel inclined, cannot hold back, but fettered to their stake, hold to their purposes, and cannot slake their fevered wills. So too this Marquis nursed his purposes, to test her as at first. And so he waited for a word or glance to show a change of heart, but there was none. No variation in her countenance could he discover. Face and heart were one. What would he have done if he had changed her mind? And as she aged, the love in her begun continued even truer, made addition, if that could be, in love and true submission. Therefore there seemed to be between these two one undivided will. If Walter pressed for something, it became her joy to do, and God be thanked, all happened for the best. And she gave proof that in whatever test a wife as of herself in nothing should direct her will, but as her husband would. Walter's ill fame began to mount and spread. His cruel soul had led him to embark, having wed a pauper, people said, on murdering both his children in the dark. Such was the common murmur and remark. No wonder, common rumours all concurred, he'd murdered them, there came no other word. And so the love his people felt of yore turned into hatred. Scandal and ill fame are things a man may well be hated for. To be called a murderer is a hateful name. Yet he, in game or earnest, with the same cruel device, strove on to what he sought. To test her further was his only thought. Now when his daughter was some 12 years old, he sent to Rome, long cunningly apprised of his intentions, and the court was told that such a papal bull should be devised that his fell purpose might be realised, and that the Pope, to set all minds at rest, should bid him wed again, as he thought best. I say he ordered them to counterfeit a papal bull declaring approbation of a divorce, while Walter then could meet objection with a papal dispensation, and calm the rancour and the indignation between his people and him. They framed the bull and published the whole forgery in full. The common people, and no wonder, held or supposed that things were even so. But when these tidings came to poor Griselde, I deem her heart was weighted down with woe. But she, and now, no less than long ago, was ready, humble creature, faithfully, to meet misfortune and adversity. And still she waited on his will and pleasure, to whom she had been given heart and soul, as to her one unfailing worldly treasure. Yet to be brief about it, and control my tale, the Marquis, now to reach his goal, devised a letter that declared his aim, and to Bologna secretly it came. It was for Lord Panaro, Panico, for the Earl, who had espoused his sister, and requested that he would send him home his boy and girl in public state and openly invested with every honour. But it still protested that upon no account should he declare, even if questioned, whose the children were. But say the maid was shortly to espouse the Marquis of Saluzzo, and thereto the Earl agreed. As day began to rouse, he started on the journey, and he drew towards Saluzzo with a retinue of many lords in rich array to guide this maiden and the brother at her side. All in her wedding dress and fresh as heaven, she rode in pearl and gold without alloy. Her brother, too, a little lad of 7, looked freshly in the tunic of a boy. So, with great splendour, every face in joy, they shaped their journey, riding all the way, and thus they neared Saluzzo, day by day. As we proceed towards the end, the fifth part is Walter publicly announced to Griseldis that he was compelled to yield to the desire of his people to marry someone of rank, and that the Pope had permitted him to divorce. Griseldis replied that she was grateful for the years of marriage, of which she was unworthy, and that she could go back to Janicula's house. She returned all her possessions to Walter, but begged him to allow her to keep a smock, so that she did not have to walk naked before the people. Her request was granted, and she went home dry-eyed, followed by the grief-stricken crowd. She lived humbly with her father and never complained about Walter's harsh treatment. Astonishing. Absolutely astonishing. So let's go and sip it past Quinta. Among all this, after his weak usage, this Marquis, yet his wife to tempt more, to the outrest proof of her courage, utmost proof of her heart. Fully to han experience and lure knowledge, if that she were as steadfast as before. He on a day in open audience full boisterously hath said her this sentence, roughly, boisterously. Enough is insufficient. Certes, Griselda, I had enough pleasance, I had sufficient pleasance to hand you to my wife for your goodness. As for your truth and your obeisance, your faithfulness, naught for your lineage, nay for your riches. To hand you to my wife for your goodness. As for your truth and your obeisance, not for your lineage, not for your richness. And now know I in very soothfastness that in great lordship, if I well advise, if I judge correctly, there is great servitude in sundry ways. I may not do as every ploughman may, my people me constraineth for to take another wife, and crying day by day, and eke the Pope rancour for to slake, consenteth it, that dare I undertake, and truly thus much I will you say, my new wife is coming by the way. Be strong of heart, and void anon her place, and vacate her place. But thilk dower that you brought in me, take it again. I grant it of my grace, returneth to your father's house, quoth he. No man may always hand prosperity. With even heart, with tranquil heart, I read you to endure. I advise you to endure the spook of fortune or of adventure. And she again answered in patience, "My lord," quoth she, "I woot and wist alway, how that betwixt your magnificence and my poverty no wight can nay may. Make in comparison. It is no nay. It cannot be denied. I ne held me never dean worthy in no manner to be your wife, no, nay, your chambermaid, chambre. And in this house, there ye me lady made, Mr. Shoy. And in this house, there ye me lady made, the hay god take I for my witness. And also, wistly, surely, he my soul glad, I never held me lady ne'er mistress, but humble servant to your worthiness, never shall, while that my life may endure, above an every worlded creature, that ye so long of your benignity hath holden me in honour and no blay, whereas I nought worthy for to be, that thanker I God and yow to whom I pray, for yield it yow, but he reward you. There is no more to say. Unto my father gladly will I wend, and with him dwell until my life's end. Then there I was fostered of a child full small, till I be deed my life there will I lead. A widow, clean in body, heart, and all, chaste in body, heart, and all. For sith I yaff to you my maidenhead, for sith I yaff to you my maidenhead, and I'm your true wife, it is no dread. God shielder such a lord's wife to take another man to husband or to make. God forbid such a lord's wife to take another man to housebound or to make. So she's going to stay chaste for him. Or to make, mate. That means, for sith I gave to you my maidenhead, and I'm your true wife, it is no dread. God forbid such a lord's wife to take another man to housebond or to mate. And as of your new wife, God of his grace, so grant ye weal and prosperity, happiness and prosperity, for I will gladly yield in her my place in which that I was blissful wont to be. Not surprised. For sith it liketh ye, my lord, quoth she, that hilloom wherein all my heart's rest, that I shall goan, I will go when ye are lest. But there, as ye may proffer, switch dowry, as I first bought, it is well in my mind, it were my wretched clothes, no thing fair, the which to me were hard now for to find. O good God, how gentle and how kind ye deemed by your speech and your visage the day that mate was our marriage. But sooth is said, algate I find it true, for in effect it proved as unme. Love is not old as when that it is new, but certes, Lord, for noon adversity, for whatever happens, for noon adversity, to dying in this cast it shall not be, even to die it shall not be, that ever in word or work I shall repent that ow yaff your mine heart in hool on taunt, completely, in whole intent. My lord, ye woot that in my father's place ye did me streep out of my pover's weed clothing, and richly me cladden of your grace, to yow bought I nought else out of dread, out of fear, but faith and nakedness and maidenhead. And here again my clothing I restore, and eke my wedding ring for evermore. The remnant of your jewels ready be in with your chamber, within your chamber. Dare I swiftly say, in naked out of my father's house, quoth she, I came, and naked moot I turn again. All your pleasance will I falben fain, but yet I hope it be not your intent that I smokeless out of your palace went, without a smock. Dishonesty. You could not do so dishonest a thing, so shameful a thing, that thilke womb in which your child lay should perform the people in my walking be seen all bare. Wherefore I now pray, let me not like a worm go by the way. Remember how Remember, Yao, mine own lord, so dear, I was your wife, though I unworthy were. Wherefore, in gedown of my maidenhead, in return for my maidenhead, which that I bought, and naught again I bear, as voucheth soft to yeave me to my meed, to my reward, but switch a smock, as I was wont to wear, that I therewith may rye the womb of here that was the wife. Rye, cover the womb of here that was your wife, and here I take my leave of you, mine own lord, lest I yow grieve. The smock would he that thou hast on thy back, let it be still and bear it forth with thee, but well unneath silke word he spake, well unneath with great difficulty every word he spake, but went his way for wrath and for pity. Afore the people herself strippeth she, and in her smock with heaved and feet all bare, toward her father's house forth as she fare, the folk her falben, weeping in her way, and fortune aye they curse and as they go, but she from weeping kept her iron dry, nay in this time word nay spake she none. Her father, that this tiding heard anon, curseth the day and time that nature shoop him to being a live's creature, made him a living creature. For out of doubt this old poverer man was ever in suspect of her marriage, but ever he deemed, sith that it began, that when the Lord fulfilled had her his desire, courage, him would think it were a disparage, a dishonour, to his estate so low for to alight, and void in her as soon as ever he might, alight, descend, and void in her, get rid of her as soon as he might. Agains, towards, agains his daughter, hastily goeth he, for he by nose of folk knew her coming, and with her old coat, as it might be, he covered her, full sore, sorrowfully, weeping. But on her body might he it not bring, for rude was a cloth, and she more of age, by days feeler than at her marriage. By days many than at a marriage, and she more of age by days many was than was at a marriage. Thus with his father, her father for a certain space dwelleth this flower of wifely patience, that neither by her words nor her face before the folk nor eke in her absence, nay showed she that her was doing offence, nor of her high estate no remembrance, nor had she as by her countenance. No wonder is for her greatest state, no eke in her absence by avoiding company. Before the folk, no eke in her absence, not by avoiding company. No wonder is for in her greatest state, her ghost was ever in plain humility. No tender mouth, no pampered mouth, no heart delicate, no self-indulgent heart, no pomp, no semblance of reality, appearance of royalty, but full of patience, benignity. Discreet and prideless, I honourable, and to her house bond ever make and stable. Men speak of Job, and moosed for his humbleness, as clerks, when hem lest, con well indite, namely of men, but as in soothfastness. Though clerks praise woman but a light, there can no man in humblest him acquite, as woman can. Nay, can he be half so true, as woman being, but it befall of new. From Boulogne is this Earl of Panic come, of which the fame upsprung to more and less, and to his people's ears all and some, was couth eke that a new marquisess he with him bought, in such pomp and richess, that never were there seen with man's eye so noble array in all West Lombardy. The marquis, which that planned and knew all this, ere that this earl was come, sent his message for Thilke, Selly, Parr, Griseldis, and she with humble heart and glad visage, not with no swollen thought in her courage, not with any haughtiness in her heart, came at his hest, and on her knees her set, and reverently and wisely she him greet. Griselda, quoth he, my will is outerly, this maiden that shall wedded be to me, received be tomorrow as royally, really. Like that one, really is royally. As is possible in mine own house to be, and eke that every wight in his degree hath of estate and sitting and service and high pleasance as I can best devise, I have no woman sufficient, capable, certain, the chambers for to array in ordinance, to put in order, with Elbasai, in ordinance after my lust. I have no woman capable, certain, the chambers for to array in ordinance after my lust, and there after my wish, and therefore would I fain that thine were all such manner governance. Thou knowest eke of old all my pleasance, though thine array be bad, and if Elbasai, and ill-looking, though thy array be bad, and ill-looking, do thou thy devoir of the least way, do thou thy duty in the least way. Not only, Lord, that I am glad, quoth she, to doon your lust, but I desire also, yea, for to serve and please in my degree, withouten fainting, weakening, and shall evermore, nay never, for no weal, nay no woe. Nay shall the ghost within mine heart stenter, to love your best with all my true intenter. And with that word she gun the house to dight, and tables for to set, and bed to make, and pained her to doon all that she might, praying the chambers for God's sake to hasten them, and fast sweep and shake, and she the most serviceable of all hath every chamber arraigned, and all his hall, chambers is every chambermaid arrayed, and his hall, hard working, serviceable. About an undren gan this earl alight, that with him brought these noble children tway, for which the people ran to see the sight of her array so richly bizai, rich looking, richly bizai. And then at first time among him they say that Walter was no fool, though that him less to change his wife, for it was for the best, for she is fairer as they deem in all than is Griselda, and more tender of age, and fairer fruit between them whole should fall, and more pleasant for her high lineage. His brother eke so fair was a visage, that him to see the people hath caught pleasant, commending now the Marquis' governance. O stormy people, unsad and ever untrue, I undiscreet and challenging as a vain, delighting ever in rumble that is new, in rumour that is new. For like the moon, I wax ye and wane, I full of clapping, dear, in now a Jane. Good Lord. Your doom is false, your constance evil proveth, a full Greek fool is he that on yow liveth. Clapping, chattering, doom, judgment, leveth, believes, that on you believes. Thus Sadon's sad folk in that city, when that the people gazed up and down, for they were glad, right for the novelty, to Hannah new laden of her town. None more for this make I now mention. Sad in that case means constant. Thus said constant folk in that city, when that the people gazed up and down, they were glad, right for the novelty. But to Griselda again will I me address, but and tell her constance and her busyness. Fall busy was Griselda in everything, that to the feast was appurtenant, suitable. Right naught was she abased of her clothing, right naught was she embarrassed of her clothing, though it were rude, and some del eke to rent, and also pretty ragged. But with glad cheer to the yate she went, as she went with other folk to the gate she went, to greet the marquisess, and after doeth forth her busyness. With so glad cheer his guests she receiveth, and so cunningly and so skillfully, ever rich in his degree, that no default no man aperceiveth, but I wondering that she might be, that in so poor a way was for to see, and could switch honour and reverence, and worldly they praise in her prudence. Defroat is fault. And all this meanwhile she, nay stenter, this maid and eke her brother to commend, with all her heart in full benign entente, so well that no man could her praise amend, so her praise improve. But at the last, when that these lords wender to sit and down to meet, he gan to call Grizzild as she was busy in his hall. Grizzild, quoth he, as it were in his play, how liketh thee my wife and her beauty? Right well, quoth she, my lord, for in good fay I fairer saw I never knew than she. I pray to God ye've high prosperity, and hope that I, that he will to you send pleasance enough unto your life's end. Our thing beseech I you and warn also, that ye nay preek with no tormenting this tender mare's maiden, as ye han do mow, that you afflict with no tormenting this tender maiden, as you have done to others. For she is fostered in her nourishing, in her upbringing, more tenderly, and to my supposing she could not adversity endure, as could a poor fostered creature. And when this Walter saw her patience, his glad cheer, and no malice at all, and he so oft a doon to her offence, and she aye sad and constant as a wall, continuing ever her innocence over all, the sturdy Marcus gan his heart address to ruin upon her wifely steadfastness. To pity on her wifely steadfastness. This is enough, Griselda mine, quoth he, but now no more aghast, nay evil appaid, displeased. This is enough, Griselda mine, quoth he, but now no more aghast, no displeased, I have thy faith and thy benignity, as well as ever woman was assayed in great estate, and poorly arrayed, now know I, dear wife, thy steadfastness, and her in arms took and gan her kiss, and she for wonder took of it no keep. She heard not what thing he to her said, she further as she had her stirred out of her sleep, she behaved as she sat out of sleep, till she out of her mazedness abrayed, out of her swoon awakened. Grizzild, quoth he, by God that fought us deed, thou art my wife, no one other I have, nay never had, as God my soul save. This is my daughter, which thou hast supposed to be my wife, that Uther faithfully shall be mine heir, As I suppose, thou bear him in thy body truly. Thou bear him in thy body truly. At Boulogne have I kept them privily. Take him again, for now mayst thou not say that thou hast lorn noon of thy children tway, that thou hast lost none of thy two children. And folk that other ways have said of me, I warn him well that I have done this deed, for no malice, nay, for no cruelty, but for to assay in thee thy womanhood, and not to slee my children, God forbid, for to keep them preverly and still, till I thy purpose knew and all my will. When this she heard, a swoon down she falleth, in a faint down she falleth, with piteous joy. And after her swooning, she both the young children unto her calleth, and in her arms, piteously weeping, embraceth them, and tenderly kissing, full like a mother, with her salt tears, she batheth both her visage and her harris. And her hairs? Oh, hers, her face and her hair, of which a piteous thing it was to see, her swooning and her humbled voice to hear. Grant mercy, Lord, God thank it now, quoth she. that ye han saved me, my children dear. Now Rika, I never to have been dead right here, sith I stunned her in your love and in your grace. No force of death, nay, when my spirit pace, a tender, a dear, a younger children mine, your woeful mother wender steadfastly, that cruel hounds on some foul vermin had eaten the owl, but God, of his mercy, and your benign father tenderly hath doon the owl kept. And in that same stounder, all suddenly she swapped a doon to grounder. And in her swow, so sadly holdeth she her children too, when she gan hem to embrace, that with great sleet and great difficulty, great ingenuity and great difficulty, the children from her arm, they gan erase, they freed themselves. Of many a tear, of many a piteous face, doomed ran of hem that stood in her beside, underneath about her might they abide. Walter her gladdeth, and her sorrow slaketh. She riseth up abased from her trance, and every wight her joy and feast maketh, till she hath caught again her countenance. Walter her doeth so faithfully pleasant, that it was dainty for to see in the cheer betwixt them two, now they been met afear together. Thy's ladies, when that they her time say, and taken her and into her chamber goon, time suitable moment, and stripping her out of all her rude array, and a cloth of gold that bright shone, with a coron of many a rich stone upon her bed, they into hall her brought, and there she was honoured as her ought. Thus hath this piteous day a blissful end. Every man and woman doth this his might, this day in mirth and revel to dispend. Till on the Weltney and the sky shone the stars' light, Weltney sky, for more solemn pee in every man's sight. This feast was, and Greta of Costage, and was the revel of her marriage, greater of Costage, more costly. For many a year in high prosperity, living this too in concord and in rest, and richly his daughter married he unto a lord, one of the worthiest of all Italy. And then in peace and rest, his wife's father and his court he keepeth, till that the soul out of his body creepeth. His son succeedeth in his heritage, in rest and peace after his father day, and fortunate was eke his marriage. All put is not his wife in greater say. This world is not so strong, it is no nay. It cannot be denied, as it hath been in old times yore. And hearkeneth what this auctor saith therefore concerning this. This story is said not for the wives should Folwyn Griselda as in humility, but it were importable, intolerable, though they would, but for that every wight in his degree should be constant in adversity, as was Griselda.